workaholic.
Jennifer. I'm Kelly. I'm an addict.
Hi, Kelly.
We'd like to open this with like a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer to kind of collect ourselves a little bit, buy some time. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference today.
All right. First things first. CA does not have anything to do with this website or anything on tap. That was just a personal tool that was used by one of the members here. And if I blacked it out with a permanent marker, it would ruin the writing on the backside. So just now that we got that clarified. I'm going to ask that you guys help us read this story. We could start with you, Jeff, and then just go around the room. Yeah. And all you have to do is just read one paragraph or two and just stop kind of where you want and just everybody read just a little bit. We'd appreciate it. Please take the microphone, though.
That's why we all sat on one side. Mm-hmm. Oh, the trick.
The Professor and the Paradox. Uh-huh. Yeah, is it on?
Yeah,
it's recording.
Okay.
That's your paragraph.
What?
Thanks.
Cool.
Yeah. Says he. We AAs surrender to win. We give away to keep. We suffer to get well, and we die to live. I'm in the public information business. I use that phrase or designation because if I say I am a college professor, everybody always has a tendency to run the other way. And when they learn that I'm a specialist in English, they have looks of horror for fear they are going to slip up and say, ain't. I often wish I sold shoes or insurance or fixed automobiles or plumbed pipes. I would have more friends.
My story is not a great deal different from others, except in a few specific details. All the roads of alcoholism lead to the same place and condition. I suppose I have always been shy, sensitive, fearful, envious, and resentful, which in turn leads one, to be arrogantly independent and defiant personality. I believe I got a PhD degree principally because I wanted to either outdo or defy everybody else. I have published a great deal of scholarly research, I think for the same reason. Such determination, such striving for perfection is undoubtedly an admirable and practical qualified to have for a while. But when a person mixes such a quality with alcohol, that quality can eventually cut him almost to pieces. At least it did so to me. I began drinking as a social drinker in my early 20s. Drinking constituted no problem for me until well after I finished graduate school at the age of 30, but as the tensions and anxieties of my life began to mount and the setbacks from perfection began to increase, I finally slipped over the line between moderate drinking and alcoholism. No longer would I drink a few beers or cocktails or two and let it go at that. No longer did I let months or even weeks go by without liquor. And when drinking, I entered what I know now was the dream world of alcoholic fantasy. Then for about 5 years of progressively worse alcoholic drinking, of fulfilling my life and home with more and more wreckage, it looked as if I were going to ride this toboggan of destruction to the bitter end.
Maybe I didn't get as bad as some of the others. I must confess that I never went to teach one of my classes drunk or drinking, but I've been awfully hungover. My pattern was to be drunk at night, boil myself out to creep to work in the morning, drunk the next night, boil myself out in the morning, drunk again the next night, boil myself out the next morning. I may not have drunk as much whiskey as some, but there isn't anybody who's drunk as more cell heptica than I have.
Now there are all kinds of drunks, melancholy drunks, weeping drunks, traveling drunks, slap happy and stupid drunks, and a number of other varieties. I was aggrandizing, and occasionally violent drunk. You wouldn't think a little fellow like me could do much damage, but when I'm drunk, I'm pure dynamite. I'm not going into any of the details. The university can fire me yet. I came to believe, actually, that life was not worth living unless I could drink. I was utterly miserable and sometimes desperate, living always with a feeling of impending calamity. I knew something was bound to break loose. And to do away with such a fear, I would try a little bit more drinking, with the inevitable result, for by this time one drink would set up in me that irresistible urge to take another and another until I was down or hungover and in trouble. In the next hungover stage, I would vow never to touch another drop and then be drunk the next night.
I knew at least that there had to be some changes made. I tried to change the time and place and amount of my drinking. I tried to change my environment, my place of living. Like most of us who at one time or another that our trouble is geography rather than whiskey. I even entertained the idea of changing wives. I tried to change everything and everybody except myself. The only thing I could change.
I did not know that it was physically impossible for me to drink moderately. I did not know that my body's drinking machinery had worn out and that the parts could not be replaced. I did not know that just one drink made it impossible for me to control my behavior and conduct and my future drinking. I did not know, in short, that I was powerless over alcohol. My family and my friends sensed or knew these things about me long before I did. Finally, as with most of us AA, most of us in AA, the crisis came. I realized I had a drinking problem which had to be solved. My wife and a close friend tried to persuade me to contact the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous we knew of in the town. This I refused to do, but I agreed that I would stop drinking altogether, maintaining stoutly and sincerely that I could and would solve this problem on my own. I would feel much better doing it that way, and I insisted. I stayed sober for 2 entire weeks, then I pitched a Lulu, a terrific drunken affair in which I became violently insane. I also landed in the city jail.
I didn't know exactly what happened on this bender, but there were some things that did happen which I was told about subsequently. First, the officers who had come out to my house did not want me to take me. They didn't want to take me in, but I insisted. Also, I insisted that they wait in the living room while I went back to the bedroom and changed into my best and newest suit with socks and tie to match, so that I would like. So I would look nice in jail. I didn't remember the ride downtown. But when I came up to in the jail corridor, I didn't like the looks of the little cage that they were shoving me into. Excuse me. So I took issue about that with the three officers and indulged in some fist cuffs with all three of them at once, each one of them twice my size and armed with a gun and a blackjack. Now what kind of thinking and acting is that? If that isn't insanity or a board, I can't pronounce that. Yeah, or some sort of mental illness, what is it? Because I yelled so loud and made it so much noise, I end up downstairs under the concrete in a place they call solitary. That's a fine place now, isn't it, for a college professor to spend the night. 2 days later, I was willing to try AA, which I had only vaguely heard of a few months before. I called at the home of a man who started started the AA group in my town, I'm sorry. And I went humbly with him to the AA meeting the following night. As I look back, something must have happened to.
Okay, I don't got my glasses, so pass. Are there reading glasses?
Reading glasses.
Good. Thanks. to me during those 2 days. Some forces must have been at work, which I did not understand. But at those 2 days between jail and AA, something happened to me that had never happened before. I repeat, I don't know what it was. Maybe I had made a decision, just part of the step three. I had made a lot of promises, but never had a decision. Though it seems to me that I was, at the time, too confused and fogged up to make much of one. Maybe it was a guiding of God, or as we Baptists say, the Holy Spirit. I like to think that it was just that, followed by my own attempts to take the 12th step to my recovery, whatever it was. I had been in AA, and I have been dry ever since. That was more than 6 years ago. AA does not function in the way that which people normally expect to. For example, instead of using our willpower, as everyone outside AA seems to think that we do, we give up the will to the higher power, place our lives in his hands, invisible hands stronger than ours. Another example, if 20 or 30 of the real drunks get away from home and meet in a club room downtown on Saturday night, the normal expectation is that all 30 of us will surely get roaring drunk. But it doesn't work that way, does it? Or taking about whiskey or old drinking days, one would normally think it's sure to raise the thirst, but it doesn't work that way either, does it? Our program and procedure seems to be in many ways contrary to the normal opinion. And so, in the connection of this idea, let me pass on what I consider to be four paradoxes of how AA works. The paradox you probably already know is that the statement in which seemingly self-contradictory, a statement of which appears to be a false, but which upon careful.
Statement which appears to be false, but which upon careful examination in certain instances proves to be true. Number one, we surrender to win. On the face of it, surrendering certainly does not seem like winning, but it is in AA. After we have come in or come to end our rope, to the end of our rope, hit a stone wall in some aspect of our lives beyond which can go no further. Only when we hit bottom in despair and surrender can we accomplish sobriety, which we could never accomplish before. We must, and we do, surrender in order to win.
Two, we give away to keep. That seems absurd and untrue. How can you keep anything if you give it away? But in order to keep whatever it is we get in AA, we must go about giving it away to others, for no fees or rewards of any kind. When we cannot afford to give away what we have received so freely in AA, we had better get ready for our next drunk. It will happen every time. We've got to continue to give it away in order to keep it.
Three, we suffer to get well. There is no way to escape this terrible suffering of remorse and regret and shame and embarrassment which starts us on the road to getting well from our affliction. There is no new way to shake out a hangover. It's painful, and for us, necessarily so. I told this to a friend of mine as he sat weaving to and fro on the side of the bed in terrible shape, about to die for some Perellahide. I said, Lost John, that's his nickname. Lost John, you know what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to do a certain amount of shaking sooner or later. Well, he said, for God's sake, let's make it later. We suffer to get well.
we die to live. That is a beautiful paradox straight out of the biblical idea of being born again or losing one's life to find it. When we work at our 12 steps, the old life of guzzling and fuzzy thinking and all that goes with it gradually dies, and we acquire a different and a better way of life. As our shortcomings are removed, one life of us dies and another life of us lives. We in AA die to live.
Thank you, everybody. Your turn, Kelly. All right. So, now that we've read through that, we're going to discuss the paradoxes. The first paradox, we surrender to win. This goes hand in hand with the first step. We admitted we were powerless over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances, that our lives had become unmanageable. There are several instances in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous which support this correlation. I have a couple of quotes written down. One of them is, "We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed." That's from page 30 from More About Alcoholism. Now, it seems quite a paradox to say that you must surrender to win, because we usually would associate surrender with, you know, like in a battle, retreating or failing. So it doesn't really make sense that we could win, but we can't fight our addiction. You know, this opponent has us so beaten down that we have no power over it. We can't win through brute force, you know. So the only way for us to get past it is to just stop fighting. And this can be hard, you know. There's another quote. "We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink." That's from page 24. So as you can see, you know, it says right there, we're without defense. You know, our mental facilities cannot possibly hold up against this. "There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. We do this to ourselves over and over again, and there's just no way around it other than surrender." There's actually a part in, I can't remember what page it's on, I'm not even going to attempt to find it, but there's a part where it says about, "We stop fighting everything and everyone, including alcohol." Someone described it to me as a 10th step promise. I didn't know there were other promises. I thought there were only the 9th step promises, but there were actually 10th step promises. And someone was explaining this to me earlier today. And it says that we stopped fighting everyone and everything, including alcohol, that we have to surrender, you know, because what kind of life are we living if we spend our whole life fighting? What kind of life is that? It's miserable, you know. I mean, anyone who's ever been in a fight knows it kind of sucks, you know. Especially if you're on the losing end of that fight, which, you know, with addiction, we always are on the losing end. And it's just, it's a miserable way to live. So we have this mental twist, though, this mental twist that tells us that we can beat it. See, this is the only, I heard somebody say that this is the only disease that tells us we don't have a disease. I found that interesting. That's kind of another little paradox there. But, you know, this cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it truly is, you know, just,
there's only one way to win against this. And there's actually a quote I have in here. Let me find it real quick. Here's where the surrendering to win really comes in. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. When we surrender, we're not giving up. You know, there's a huge difference. When we surrender, we're not giving up the fight. We're giving it to God or our higher power. Whatever you may choose your higher power to be, we are giving our battle up to our higher power. And our higher power is the only one who can handle it. We can't. We don't have that power. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. You know, that just says it all right there. We can't do this on self-will. We can't fight it on our own. So we surrender. We surrender it to our higher power, and that's how we win. That's the only way to win. Yes, I'm turning it over to you now.
All right, paradox two. We give it away to keep it. You know, one of the reasons I'm here today is because somebody worked their 12th step on me. Somebody gave away what they had got so freely to me so that I could be here today to pass it on and do the same thing. It's one of the big things that this program teaches me from the very start. There's a lot of things in this book that supports, you know, giving away. I've marked several things in here. Which is some of these I'm going to share with you. You know, starting with the forward to the second edition talks about, you know, prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic, but he had succeeded in only keeping himself sober. It's one of the things, you know, we may not help somebody else stay sober, which I hope, you know, when I share the message that, you know, it touches somebody and that they do stay sober. But, you know, it's partly selfish because I got to keep myself sober today. You know, I have to, you know, give it away to keep it, you know. So, and that's where, you know, it goes on a little further down. And it says, he suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. You know, and it's written in our traditions, our fifth tradition. Our primary purpose is to carry the message to the addict that still suffers. You know, that's what we're here for. We get clean and sober to help have a better life and to not be sick anymore. But we also have a responsibility to each other to carry this message. And that doesn't necessarily mean necessarily going into a hospital, an institution, and carrying the message. That's a great way to do it. But when you're sitting around, you know, the rooms in your little break-off groups, you're carrying the message and you're giving it away when you say, hey, this is my experience with the first step, or this is my experience with the 12th step. You know, we give it away in so many ways that we don't realize it. You know, it's not just about going into a hospital or institution or doing stuff like this. It's so many little things. You know, answering that phone when somebody calls, a sponsee calls, and you're like, oh, I'm tired, I just want to go to bed. You know, and you answer that phone, and they're like, hey, I'm just checking in today. You know, maybe that's all they needed. You know, it's just the little things that we do that we give away to somebody else. You know, there's a few more things I wanted to read in the big book here, because it's supported in so many ways in this book. You know, that's not the one I wanted to read. In the forward to the fourth edition, in any meeting anywhere, AA share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem or face to face, AA speak the language of the heart and in all its power and simplicity. That's what it's all about. It's all about helping each other. It's all about sharing the love, you know, and it's all about, you know, carrying the message. Carrying the message. Give it away. I wouldn't be here today if somebody hadn't given it to me. None of us would be. So we need to continue to give it away to others. And there's a little story in the fourth edition of the big book. This story here that y'all read It's available in the second edition of the Big Book. But if you ever read these stories, there's some great messages in here, and this is the way people are giving it away, you know. But this story here, it just hit me one day. One day I decided I'd better go to the laundromat and wash some clothes. There was a woman there with a couple of kids. She moved around quickly, folding clothes and stacking them neatly in a couple of huge baskets. Where did she get her energy? Suddenly, I realized I had put my clothes into the dryers. I couldn't remember which washers. I had to put my clothes in the dryers. I couldn't remember which washers I had put them in. I looked into probably 20 different washers. I made up my mind how to handle the situation. I would stay here until everyone else had left. I would keep whatever clothes were left behind, as well as my own. As the other woman finished her task, she was writing something down on a small piece of paper. She loaded her baskets and kids into her car and came back into the laundromat. She came right up to me and handed me the small blue paper. I couldn't make out what it said. I smiled politely and slurred a friendly thank you. Later, I made out the telephone number and the handwritten message below. If you ever want to stop drinking, call Alcoholics Anonymous 24 hours a day. Why had she given me this? And what made her think I was drinking? Couldn't she see that my bottle was soda? All the nerve. I was mortified. I folded the paper neatly and put it in the back pocket of my jeans. As the next few weeks passed, I became sicker by the day. One morning, I woke up alone as usual. I hadn't seen my husband in a long time. I needed a drink, and the bottle on the bedside table was dry. I rose on my shaky legs, but they refused to hold my weight. I fell to the floor and began crawling around the house looking for a bottle. Nothing. This meant I had to leave the house and go to the store. I found my empty purse on the floor, but I knew I could never make it to the car. I became terrified. Who could I call? I never saw any friends anymore, and there was no way I could call family. I remembered the number in the pocket of my jeans. I hadn't even gotten dressed for several days. Where were the jeans? I searched the house until I found them on the floor of the bedroom. The number was in the pocket. After three tries, I managed to dial the number. A woman's voice answered. I got this number from you. Is this AA, I asked? Yes. Do you want to stop drinking? Please, yes. I need help. Oh, God. I felt the fiery tears run down my face. 5 minutes later, she pulled into my driveway. She must have been some kind of an angel. How had she appeared from nowhere that day in the laundromat? How had she known? How had I kept her number all that time without losing it? That was just one woman giving it away, and she never knew how it would affect this person. But this woman has stayed sober since then. You know, and then she shared this story, and it's just so amazing what little things we can do that it touches somebody else. Maybe not at that moment, but maybe 5 minutes later, years down the road, you know. So we have a responsibility to give it away. Back at you.
Thanks, Jen. The third paradox, we suffer to get well. Now, this is where I can share a little bit of my story with you guys. We all have to hit a bottom in order to seek recovery. It says right in the Big Book that most of us probably had time to stop. But while we had the time to stop, the consequences were not bad enough to make us want to stop. You know, like while we were able to, it wasn't bad enough for us to want to. And once things got bad enough for us to want to stop, we couldn't anymore. We had lost that power. We had crossed the line into addiction or alcoholism beyond the point of human aid. So we have to suffer to get well. I started using young. I got progressively worse, and I got the unmanageability crept in by the time I was about 14 years old. I was in high school, freshman year. I was already only going to like one out of the nine classes I had a day, skipping out all the time to get high and whatever. That unmanageability continued to spiral as my family started to catch on. The teachers started to complain to my parents that I wasn't in class, that I wasn't doing this, I wasn't doing that. My parents started bringing it back to me. I eventually was expelled from my first high school. I went to another high school, and at the second high school, you know, I met a whole new group of friends, and these friends liked to party even harder than the old group of friends. So I was like, why not? So things continued to kind of, you know, tailspin out of control. I got a job working at a doggy daycare where I worked outside. So, you know, I was able to smoke outside, you know, not just cigarettes. But things fell apart really fast towards the end. Within a period of about, I want to say it was between 2 weeks and a month, I had lost all of my friends except for two. Katie and Frost were the two friends that I had left. They were trying to help me get off the drugs on my own. Yeah, we all know how well that works out. I had lost my job. I had been kicked out of my home. And, you know, it's like as things continued to degrade, I kept hanging on to what little I had left. You know, it was like, okay, well, my family has disowned me, but at least I can still live there. And then once they kicked me out, it was like, okay, well, my family's disowned me and I have no place to live, but at least I still have a job and my friends. And then my friends abandoned me and it was like, okay, so I'm kind of getting lonely here, guys, but at least I still have my job, right? You know, like that's all good. And then I lost my job. And so I was homeless on the northwest side of Milwaukee, sleeping under bridges. I had a broken leg. My mom had thrown me out of the house without giving me my crutches, so I had to walk on it. I was in such a spiritual bankruptcy. You know, I had no hope left. I had no faith. I had no faith in anything. I didn't have faith in me, in a higher power, in the world, in humanity, in anything. You know, I'd like to share a little story with you from when I was homeless, just to illustrate how desperate things got. I went into a church, and I don't know what I was looking for. I guess on some level I was looking for, you know, a priest or, you know, a nun. You know, all these things were just flashing through my head that I thought of seeing in churches. I was looking for safety and comfort, I guess. Looking for God, some kind of relief. So I went into this church, and there was nobody in there, and it was dark and quiet. And I walked in, and I'm walking around, you know, the main, I can't remember what it's called, but the main room, whatever. And I found a bottle of wine on the altar. So I took that, I downed it, and I ran like hell out of the church. And by that point, I hoped nobody was there. All my thoughts of comfort and safety disappeared. As soon as I downed that wine, I hoped there was nobody there. I hoped there was no God to see what I had just done, and I booked it. Now that just goes to show that nothing is sacred. When you're out there actively using, nothing is, there's no line drawn in the sand anymore. There's no line that, oh, I can't do that, that would be too bad. It just, the line just disappears. And I think the line disappears because I crossed it so long ago it's out of sight. But there was definitely suffering. You know, that, just to be willing to do anything it takes to get relief from the pain I was in just goes to show it. And the suffering we go through within recovery doesn't compare to the suffering of using. There is suffering in recovery, but it's not on such an immense scale. You know, there's a quote in the Big Book that says, almost none of us liked the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. You know, I don't know if I'd even call it suffering, more as, you know, humbling, which I guess could be considered suffering for some people, if, you know, because it hurts our pride. Our pride gets out of hand when we're out there, and that gets hurt when we come in. But it's necessary for us to live the way we need to live in order to stay alive, you know, and that's all we can do. So we do suffer immensely, especially when using, but once we get through that period of suffering and we can recognize just how miserable we are, it enables us to get well. So with that, I'm going to pass to Jen.
Thanks, Kelly. We die to live, you know, and it says here that is a beautiful paradox straight out of the biblical idea of being born again. You know, just my personal opinion, I know for me that when you're baptized, it washes away everything and you're a clean person and it's a brand new slate. Well, it doesn't happen like that quick and magically in recovery for me, I know. It takes time. I have to be willing to do this deal. I have to be willing to work the steps. You know, I was dying out there, but I was dying physically. I was dying spiritually. I was just dying as a person. I hated who I had become. I hated who I was. You know, I hated my life. You know, I didn't want to be that person anymore. So when I come in here, I was ready to take the steps that I needed to take. You know, and kind of when they're like, well, you got to die, you got to, you know, the only thing you got to change is everything. You know, I think I got to be willing to change everything. Because, you know, when I come in here, you know, there's some traits that I have. When I do my personal inventory, there are some traits that I have that aren't all bad. You know, I'm not a 100% evil, bad person. There is, you know, a little bit of good in me. So, you know, I have to be willing to change everything. Doesn't mean I have to change everything. You know, and when I started reading this book, some of it, you know, because you hear about, like, the psychic changes, you know, like here. One feels that something more than a human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. And then one of the things I saw early on was Bill's story, and it's like he's in the hospital, and then, boom, he saw the light, and he's this whole brand-new person, and, you know, it's like, when I come in here, that wasn't my experience at all. And one of the things it talks about in the spiritual experience, actually in the back of the book, which is a really good thing for me to read, it doesn't have to be that lightning bolt experience. For some of us, it is a slow growing experience. You know, it happens over time. You know, we slowly start to change, you know, by working these steps, by, you know, practicing these principles in our lives, by, you know, doing the next right thing, taking the baby steps. It comes over time, you know, but we have to be willing to change. We have to be willing to do this process, you know, and I have to be willing to get rid of the self-seeking, you know, the selfishness, the resentments that, you know, keep me sick, all that good stuff, you know. I have to be willing to change who I am, you know. I highlighted several things in this book because there's so much stuff in here that it talks about, you know, the spiritual change and the needing to. like this. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it was really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator God has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. You know, this program is awesome, you know, in my opinion. I don't know about y'all's opinion, but in my opinion, I love it. And, you know, there's so many things in this book that supports these paradoxes. It's hard for me to read them all. I mean, I would love to sit up here and just read them all to y'all. But we also want to see what you guys think about this and, you know, if you guys have any opinions or, you know, any stories that you'd like to share on the paradoxes and how they affect your lives. You know, so with that, I'm going to open up the floor for comments or questions or whatever. Going once?
Hi, everybody. My name's Kim. I'm an alcoholic drug addict.
Hi, Kim. Hi, Kim.
I just want to say real quick that you guys did a great job up there. I didn't know, you know, I don't remember ever reading this chapter, so it was a very good story, and I could totally relate to both of you and relate to the four paradoxes, and I don't even know which one I like best. I like all of them. Is what you guys said really hit home. Especially the, I don't even know what part was better than the other, but what I could really relate to was the suffering part, you know, because I suffered a lot out there when I was using, and I suffered a lot in recovery too. And it's like Kelly said, it's totally like a different suffering. I suffered in recovery because I chose to suffer for a long time. You know, I didn't want to let stuff go and give it to God. And now I am today. And I'm a totally different person than I was when I first came into recovery. And I'm really grateful for that. I don't know how it happened. Obviously, it was a miracle. But I think that I completely turned it over to my higher power. And I'm so glad to be at this convention. I haven't been to a CA convention in a very long time. I was suffering because I had some resentments that I'm working on today with people in CA. And that was my own bullshit, you know. Now I just love everybody, and I love CA, and you know, that's where it all started for me. And, you know, I left CA for a very long time. And I would go to functions, but I wouldn't really go to meetings. And I'm glad I'm back, really. There's a lot of new people that I've never met, and I'm meeting them today. And they're really great people. So with that, I pass.
Thanks, Kim.
Jody. Can you hear me now? My name's Jody. I'm an addict.
Hey, Jody.
I really
love to be reminded of surrendering. I need to do this on a daily basis for me. Surrendering to my disease and then remembering that I am not in charge. Because I am still very headstrong and I like to drive the bus. And then I crash into brick walls emotionally and spiritually. So I am just very grateful that I am able to be a part of life today and to come here and be reminded, because I need the reminders, because I forget so fast. Then I'm driving away and I'm like, why do I feel like shit? I feel like complete shit. Well, it's because I'm trying to control every little thing that's going on. And I'm powerless. I need to be reminded. I'm grateful that I came here to this whatever meeting, because now I feel like I got right size where I needed to be, and it feels good. So thank you.
Thanks, Jody.
Hi, everybody. Alcoholic addict named Dane. I guess the part I liked it all, but I liked the last part. You gotta die to live. And I don't know, people that clean and sober a while, you kind of forget, because of the good times you have in recovery and your life does change, that you forget of all the bad stuff. And I need to be reminded of all the bad stuff. And then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, I remember a lot of the bad stuff. And I think that's why a lot of us keep coming, because it's so easy for us. People know me. I've been in the NAS program for 20 some years. And it was a revolving door for me, because I didn't get it until I said I was done. And I had to die long enough to start living again. And I appreciate everything. When I actually get to see my kids smile, that's important to me, man. That is like God's gift, one of the biggest things of recovery. And able to spend birthdays with them, not in jail, in prison, or dead. I'm very grateful. I never thought I'd live be a happy person. I grew up an angry individual, My perception of a man was, who's tougher, can do the better hustle. I'm not that way no more, man. A man is taking care of your kids, taking care of yourself, and doing the next right thing, And I'm not perfect at all the times, but I try to do the best I can, I tolerate Packer fans to the best of my ability on a daily basis, And that's not easy. It's not easy, but I love them. But, I'm one Bear fan in a Packer country. I got to take a lot of crap, But thank you, baby. Thank you. But, and I remember using being a Bear fan, how many stupid fights I got into in the bar over being a Bear fan. I haven't been in one fight being a Bear fan, being clean and sober. What a concept, It's a fucking game. It's just a game. And those are the stupid things, simple things that life has changed in me, I wore the stuff on purpose just because they didn't think I buried it already for the year, I won't wear it no more, but until next season. But, I copy a lot of the men in recovery because I want to be a good person and a good man. Like I said, I tell a lot of people, I didn't know how to be a man until I came to recovery. And, I didn't know how to be a dad, and I didn't know how to do shit but use and manipulate and, be a piece of shit, And today I'm pretty proud of myself, and I love seeing other people grow. People are buying houses that, I never thought, God bless them, and that's what it's about. It's about, living better and being a productive member of society and being happy with yourself, But I'm glad everybody's here. I hope some more people share here, because I want to hear some more. Come on. Can I take somebody? Yeah. It's not good.
Hi, Alan. Blessed and grateful, recovering drug addict and alcoholic. Thank you so much, guys. I appreciated both of your experience. And I'm going to, keep it to what it is here. Surrender to win. And I was told early on that surrender is going over to the winning side. And I needed to really get the differentiation. I really needed to differentiate between surrender and submission. Surrender means I'm done. I've had enough. Submission means I've had enough, but if you get up, I'm going to get up and kick your ass. My experience with that stuff is that was a fight I could never win. Lord knows I got up plenty of times thinking that this time I'm going to win. This time it's going to be cool. I never won, and it was certainly never cool. give away to keep. I like that because a candle loses nothing by lighting another candle. So I get to come here and give away what is freely given to me. I was shocked that they didn't charge me anything to come here. My sponsor did not give me a bill at the end of the month. Whatever that bill would have been, it would have been well worth it. And to this day, I still tell my current sponsor that I always get my money's worth from him. Every day. Because he gives it to me, I give it to somebody else, and it's just a chain. It's just what this thing is all about, and I think that's really cool. I couldn't get well until I was really in a position of absolute suffrage. I couldn't be free unless I was in a place of absolute slavery, which is what I was. You know, I couldn't be happy unless I was totally miserable. Because if I wasn't miserable and I wasn't broke, I would have had no reason to come here. You know, I came here, this was the last house on the block. There was no place else to go. I had looked everywhere I could possibly look to avoid coming here. None of that stuff worked. The last, and certainly not least, we die to live. You know, the guy who was really important in my sobriety, my first sponsor picked up and passed away as a direct result of the disease. And what I kind of got from that is there's no going away from here. There's no, you know, I'm better. I graduate. Thanks for what I got. See you in a couple of months. You know, that doesn't happen. So, because we get to see those guys die, you know, they give their lives so that we can die. They give their lives so that we can live. They die so we can live. And that's just amazing. That's just, you know, it sucks to see that. It sucks to see that, but that's real. That's what this thing is about. That's what this thing does. So, you know, like before, like I've heard before, you know, I'm so happy to be here. I love these things. I love you guys. You know, this is the coolest game in town. I have played a lot of games. This is the coolest game in town. And I just keep coming. A, I keep coming because I really like it. B, I keep coming because I am really afraid to ever find out what happens when I stop coming. You know, I've heard often, you know, people that don't go to meetings don't get to see what happens to people that don't go to meetings. So I just keep going and I just keep doing. And I do exactly what I did. I do exactly now, you know, 12 years later, what I did when I came in here. Exactly the same. Except, of course, now I have a little more to say. The only difference. So I just keep doing it because it works. Because it's great. Because the paradoxes are not limited to these four. The paradoxes are, I mean, if you go back and you think about the difference between using and being here, every atom of my life is a paradox then to now. Thanks.
Thanks, Al.
And I'm an addict. I'd like to thank Kelly and Jennifer for bringing these four paradoxes. I agree with Alan that there has to be more than four paradoxes. And I'm so thankful and grateful for this program until it's not funny. Each day that my higher power breathes breath in my body and I rise up, I give thanks to him and to this program for keeping me clean and sober. Because right now, through 24 hours, I was no good. There was suffering. I did suffer quite a bit. And I thought that I was the only one that suffered so badly. You know, I thought no one else could suffer like I suffered. And each time I hear someone share so gratefully their stories, I see that they also suffered badly too. So it makes me feel so comfortable to be around you guys, that we share, we have things in common. And
that it lets me know that I was never alone, and I'm not alone today. It took me a long time to surrender, and I just kept fighting it. You know, like, I can do this by myself. I don't need anyone's help. I don't, you know, who do I have to rely on? I don't need to rely on anyone. So it took me a while to surrender, but I finally had to give in because I realized after getting in touch with my higher power that he was the only one that had the power, and he was the only one that can control my life. I couldn't control anything. Today, I don't try to control anything. I don't try to control my life. I leave things into his hands, and I like to thank everyone.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thanks, Barbara.
Hi, my name's Ken. I'm an addict.
Hi, Ken.
I'm not that good of a speaker, but I'm new at this. I've only been clean like 63 days now, and thank you. And you were talking about friends, and when I was using, I really didn't have friends. And so I came here to Milwaukee, and I joined the Coke Busters and stuff like that. I began to see all the friends that I could have had a long time ago. And I just want to thank all you guys for being here, and God bless you all.
Thanks, Ken.
Anyone else like to share anything? All right, then, I guess we can close with the Lord's Prayer, followed by Serenity.
Thanks, Peter.